Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the $1.1 trillion government funding bill, which the president is expected to sign, that passed the Senate Saturday night, laden with Christmas presents for Wall Street, in a blatant quid pro quo that will allow Wall Street to gamble on derivatives with the taxpayer left holding the bag, which is exactly what brought about the 2008 crash, while Wall Street is able to send checks of $324,000 to political parties instead of the maximum of $32,400 previously allowed. Bartlett Naylor, the financial policy advocate for Public Citizen, who previously served as the chief of investigations for the United States Senate Banking Committee, joins us to discuss why the Democrats caved and how Republicans got away with weakening the Dodd-Frank banking reforms passed in the wake of the 2008 financial crash, and how they will continue to weaken it further by attaching riders to future critical spending bills. Then we will speak with writer, journalist, and professor Mark Danner about his new film at Vice News, in collaboration with the New York Review of Books, How the U.S. Created the Islamic State. We will look into the role of the prison system set up by the U.S. following the invasion and occupation of Iraq that detained 24,000 men in 24 camps, including the top commanders of what was to become the senior leadership of the Islamic State, who were able to organize the terror group at Camp Buka right under the noses of their American jailers. Then finally, we will discuss the criminal state that Russia has become under the leadership of Vladimir Putin and his handful of cronies who control 35% of the country's wealth that they have stolen while merging with the global criminal underworld in a black economy that accounts for up to 50% of the world's wealth, undermining the global financial system while ironically depending upon it for stability. Karen DeWisher, the director of Russian and Post-Soviet Studies at Miami University in Ohio, joins us to discuss her new book, just out, Putin's Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia? And joining us now is Bartlett Naylor, the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as the chief of investigations for the United States Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bartlett Naylor.
Thanks very much for having me, Ian.
And the Senate had a fairly dramatic debate, I guess you could call it, on Saturday night to take up the House's Cromnibus, they called it, the continuing revolution, continuing resolution crammed into an omnibus must-pass spending bill to keep the government funded. There were lots of hijinks from the two Tea Party senators, Ted Cruz and Mike Lee, who interfered with the passage, trying to strip out the president's so-called unconstitutional vote on immigration. But that, of course, ironically allowed Harry Reid to push through a bunch of appointments that the Republicans had held up, which had been languishing for some time. So just in terms of the theatrics and the politics on Capitol Hill, particularly in the Senate, what did you make of that?
Well, yes. I mean, built into the Senate rules are that basically there has to be agreement by all 100 senators to move forward with anything. And as you mentioned, Ted Cruz in particular wanted to make a stand, and he did in fact keep the Senate in past Friday into Saturday. And as they jockeyed in the final hours of Saturday, Harry Reid made use of the final day of the Democratic majority in the Senate to move a dozen or so nominations. Of course, those rules flipped. If the rules remain the same, then the majority flips, and winning confirmations for nominations in the Republican-controlled Senate will be much more difficult to 14 Congress.
Well, yeah, Harry Reid managed to get through 24 nominees who'd been held up, but if that's good news, it seems to be pretty much outweighed, in my opinion at least, in terms of what was given away, both in the House and now in the Senate, to which the president's expected to sign, where there's such an obvious quid pro quo that Wall Street gets to gamble on derivatives with the taxpayer left holding the bag through the FDIC if anything goes wrong, as it did with the 2008 crash. And then Wall Street gets to write these big checks for $324,000 to political parties instead of the maximum of $32,400 that was previously allowed. So,
sure.
I mean, isn't that obvious that the, I mean, aren't the American people aware that this is our government for sale?
Yes, it is, unfortunately. To the extent that we need to make progress and understand what's going on, I guess the one point of optimism is that we have voices, Elizabeth Warren in particular, Senator from Massachusetts, who has energized other people who generally share her views that we need to stop this. We need to make a stand. Warren brings particular expertise to this issue. There's no other member of Congress, really, that puts as a primary point on their platform banking issues. That's sad, in my opinion, given that the financial crisis of 2008 has rendered an economy from which we're still recovering and have devastated lives that, you know, will be remembered forever. So one would hope that there would be more members of Congress that put banking policy front and center. But fortunately, she does. She's articulate and persuasive, and she helped take a stand with this one provision of Dodd-Frank on this the swaps, the gambling part, and was successful enough to move what I would call a wavering House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi into, in fact, voting against that bill so as to defend this Wall Street reform. Ranking member of the House Financial Services Committee, Maxine Waters, who had earlier not resisted this particular change in Dodd-Frank, joined in the fight. And while it's true that too many Democrats joined with the president in passing this bill last Thursday, there were a number of Democrats that I think stepped up, and presumably this will be a rehearsal of what will be necessary in the next Congress when that starts in a few weeks.
Again, I'm speaking with Bartlett Naylor, who's the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as the chief of investigations for the United States Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. Now, I don't understand, though, the logic of why the Democrats caved and why particularly the White House pushed them into this compromise. It was made by Barbara Mikulski, who's supposedly a liberal, in negotiation with the Republicans. Then when, as you say, Senator Warren gave Nancy Pelosi the backbone along with Maxine Waters, and then they basically held it up and went into caucus, and that's when the White House really went into overdrive and said, look, this is the best deal you can get. You have to vote for it. I don't understand, and the White House now says, well, this is the nature of compromise and you make the best deal you can. Well, couldn't they have made a better deal if the House would have gone ahead and the Democrats would have gone ahead and insisted on taking those two provisions out, the Dodd-Frank weakening and raising the limit on direct contributions to political parties from $32,000 to $324,000. I mean, what would the whole world have collapsed if they had stripped those two provisions out?
No, the world would have been a better place. What should have happened and what could have happened is that on Thursday they could have either taken the vote or understood that this spending bill is going to go down to defeat because of two provisions, the ones that you just made reference to, the increase in political spending contributions and this Wall Street giveaway piece. Take those out. That takes almost no time at all in terms of drafting. You just erase those sections and then bring that to the floor. Instead, the Obama administration, joined with, in fact, believe it or not, Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan, were making telephone calls right down to wavering Democrats in particular to get them to approve this. And it makes no sense. I can only speculate that when the deal was cut before it was announced to the public on late Tuesday, that's December 9th, that presumably pledges were made by various members of that deal-making effort, which would have might have included the White House. They said, okay, and we will now support this bill. You know, there are things that we didn't want that you took out, and what is left are some of these provisions, including this derivatives giveaway. And so based on that, I'm guessing the White House had already committed that they would fight for it. But, you know, if they hadn't already sold it or understood with the Democratic base what the deal was, then they should not have made those commitments. And when they did learn that there was substantial Democratic opposition, they should have removed those. They should have removed those provisions.
But it seems to me, Bart Naylor, that leverage goes both ways. That the whole point of putting these riders on a must-pass spending bill is that you have maximum leverage because the government's going to run out of money, and it's either you pass the bill or the government runs out of money. So obviously the Republicans are using that leverage to the maximum, but I don't understand why the Democrats can't use the same leverage in reverse. And furthermore, it would seem to me that having established this principle of winning in terms of who blinks when you are leveraging this situation on a must-pass bill, won't the Republicans just continue to use this tactic in the next Congress? Every time we run out of money, they're going to say, we got to pass these provisions, and they'll weaken further the Dodd-Frank bill until it just is completely gone away. And we're back to pre-2008 conditions.
Absolutely. This was a situation when the Democrats and or progressives had more leverage than they're going to have next year. They have a democratically controlled Senate. And yet our president presaged that when it gets tight, he is willing to throw Dodd-Frank provisions under the bus. He will claim, as he should and as he does believe, that it's regrettable. But, you know, this is what America pays for. And thankfully, for somebody like Senator Warner, Maxine Waters, to explain to their peers in Congress and have the American public understand, these are important. It's these difficult to understand provisions of the law that lead, in the end, to a financial crisis that has a very real impact on us all, the millions of jobs lost and foreclosures. So, again, presumably, there will be lessons learned. The president will show more spine when this drill takes place, as it inevitably will during the next Congress, and we'll have members more alert that there are going to be political repercussions when they vote for Wall Street.
Well, it's just hard to understand how the Democrats can continue to claim to be the party of the working Americans and the middle class when it's pretty clear that the Republicans are shamelessly whoring for the billionaires and Wall Street. You know, that's just a given now, and they're very faithful, but still you got 57 Democrats in the House voted along with them. And you've got the president saying this is the best deal we could get, when it clearly wasn't the best deal they could get. That's the part that I don't understand. Preemptive compromise before it's necessary.
Well, as you know, and another fight that's going on now involves the revolving door, the fact that Wall Street populates positions of influence in Washington far in excess of their proportion in the economy. Our Treasury Secretary worked for Citigroup, which, as you pointed out at the beginning, wrote the legislation, literally drafted the words that Congress passed on the House passed on Thursday, and the Senate responded on last night. We have Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, we sometimes call Washington Government Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and Wall Street officials throughout the government. And I think it's received wisdom that when advice is being rendered to the president about whether or not he should stand tough. These people work there. Their friends work there. They themselves may have received their bonus based on the same kind of risky derivatives trading that that is at issue here. And that fight is continuing. As you may know, there is the president has nominated a Lazare Frères banker to be the chief of domestic policy at the Treasury Department, and you know that Senator Warren again is leading the fight to contest that. But as long as Wall Street people are in Washington at a time when another one of these important decisions has to be made, we've got a problem. We really need real economy people, academics, that are rendering this advice to our president.
So is it possible, Bartlett Naylor, that what's really going on here is that in the last few decades, probably starting with Reagan, the real power in this country has shifted from Washington, D.C. to Wall Street?
Yes, absolutely. Numerically, the GNP is overtaken more by finance. It used to be 3 or 4%, and now it's 8 or 9%. And again, understand that finance is an intermediate industry. It's something that we use to do other things, just like trucking is an intermediate industry. And we certainly wouldn't celebrate if trucking went from 4% to 8% of the economy. We'd wonder why the trucks are driving around half empty. It is, in the context of income inequality, that as companies sell widgets and take in revenue, they're not paying the actual workers enough. Wages have stagnated and declined for working Americans, while they've grown ever more concentrated by the upper 5 and 10%. And that's no more keen than in the financial sector, where there's 1 million people that live on minimum wage in the United States. If you simply took half of the bonuses that New York taxpaying Wall Street dealers, that's just one sector of Wall Street, if you took half of their pay, you could double the wages of that other million people that are working on minimum wage. This is just an illustration that there's so much money concentrated into the financial sector. And of course, this is all made possible through the permissions of law, through deregulation, and it makes all the sense in the world that these very well-paid, overpaid financial executives would spend a part of their paycheck influencing Washington, and they do. $1.5 million a day is spent by Wall Street on lobbying every day in Washington through roughly 3,000 lobbyists.
So that is that really explains what just happened, and we can look forward to even more egregious payoffs to Wall Street at the expense of Main Street.
Well, that's certainly the physics of what's happening right now. Those are the pressures, and you make reference to Democrats. It's Republicans know it's been a cheap date for Wall Street, but it's sort of a surprise to some people that otherwise think of Democrats as the progressive party, that they've been pretty quick to jump in the back seat with Wall Street as well.
Well, Bartlett Naylor, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Bartlett Naylor, who's the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as chief of investigations for the United States Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with writer, journalist, and professor Mark Denner about his new film at Vice News, How the U.S. Created the Islamic State.
Get from out the road when you get dough, it's horrible. Time is money, spend, waste, save, invest, affest. The 10K cave a chicken chest, yes, y'all are double, get your trickles. The best ballers pitch in and rub to get a nickels. But tut tut, he about to change the price again. They go up each time, he blow up like hydrogen. Villain here, album shrilling in fear. It won't stop top bill until he a gazillionaire. Villain, his agenda is clear. Ending this year with dividends to spare here. A new meaning to sales through the roof. Guaranteed.
This is a war we can win. After 10,000 years, it's still us against them, and my heroes have always died at the end. So who's going to account for these sins?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Danner, who is a writer, journalist, and professor. Mark Danner was a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and is a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books and teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, and Bard College. His books include Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War, The Secret Way to War, The Downing Street Memo, and The Iraq War's Buried History, and Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and The War on Terror. He has a new film at Vice News in collaboration with The New York Review of Books, How the U.S. Created the Islamic State. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Danner.
Thank you, Ian. It's good to be here.
And given that the Islamic State has taken such a huge priority now, the only thing that easily passed the House and Senate for the president's signature has been supplementals to go and fight the Islamic State, and in response to the beheadings of American journalists, there was an enormous public outcry, almost on the scale of what there was after 9/11, even though thousands were killed on 9/11. From the very beginning, there doesn't seem to be any proportionality in this thing, but what you're arguing here is, I guess, the uncomfortable secret is that here again, this is blowback, is it not? This is in part our own creation.
Well, the Vice film, which was done in collaboration with the New York Review, essentially takes up a piece that I wrote in 2003 at the beginning of the Iraq War, essentially saying that this would be the result of this very ill-planned and ill-advised invasion, that the United States would create more jihadists, more jihadi organizations. And, of course, there was nothing like the Islamic State or like ISIL or ISIS in Iraq before the United States invaded and occupied Iraq. We essentially threw the Sunnis out of power. They became the rebels against the now dominant Shia regime, and ISIS and the Islamic State are a product of that. So I think throughout the war on terror, have created our own enemies, and we've done it consistently. Now that we're bombing actively the Islamic State, it's up their recruitment dramatically. As Haaretz reported recently, they've had, since the beginning of the bombing, recruitment is probably over 6,000 new members, people eager to fight the United States. So we tend to take actions which make our situation work, and I think that's worse. I think that's been the plot line since September 11th, when Al-Qaeda attacked the United States, hoping that the U.S. would invade Afghanistan and get caught in a quagmire there, as the Soviet Union had done before. And the U.S. did them one better and invaded and occupied Iraq. So we seem to be doing what they want us to do, and to the detriment of our own U.S. interests.
But this was the work of Bush and Cheney and Rice and Rumsfeld. Why is it still continuing?
Well, I think that, you know, Bush and Cheney, and of course it wasn't just Bush and Cheney, the American political elite pretty much supported it, including most of the elite figures in the Democratic Party. The only exception was Obama, who wasn't actually in the Senate at the time. He was a state senator in Illinois. I think it continues because they invaded the state and left a complete mess there. They invaded a nasty, terribly nasty place that was ruled by a very nasty regime, but they left a good deal of chaos in their wake with an unsettled political struggle going on that's still going on to this day. And it's a struggle not only within Iraq, but across the divide that separates the Middle Eastern Islamic world between Shiite and Sunni, which goes directly across the Iraqi state. which is why now you have the involvement, the deep involvement of the Iranians as well. They're involved in Iraq and they're involved in Syria as well. So we have this two-sided civil war that's going on. It's true you can trace back to Cheney, Bush, Rumsfeld, and so on, but it has survived them and has gotten much worse in the aftermath. You know, Obama, since he began bombing, is really talking, has been made it very clear that this struggle is going to go on long past his presidency. And if you listen to our military leaders, they are repeat the same thing at every opportunity, that this could go on for another decade.
Well, it seems to me that there's a political dynamic in that. The Republicans don't want to admit, which is the obvious, that Bush and Cheney, by invading Iraq, handed it over to Iran, marginalized the Sunni, and thus began this long agony that's continuing to this day and is a part of the proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And the Democrats, on the other one hand, the White House, does not want to preside over the loss of Iraq. So they're pretending that this fiction of a country still exists. And then I imagine the same will be true with Hillary Clinton or whoever becomes the next president, that they'll, not want to be branded as the regime or the administration that lost Iraq. But why can't we be honest about it? I've never understood why so few voices, except for Brent Scowcroft, who certainly knew what he was talking about, spoke up at the time about the folly of what they were doing. And ever since then, there's been this incredible silence about the obvious.
Yeah, I don't know if I would call it a silence. I mean, I think there are a fair number of people who are speaking up about it.
You included.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing to me is that this war, it is touted as a new war, and it's relatively little covered. We've taken it on board as if it's simply another piece in this kind of mosaic of global warfare that now seems to be the new normal. The new normal is drone strikes every few days in Pakistan. The new normal is drone strikes in Yemen and fixed-wing aircraft strikes in Yemen. And the new normal is steady drone strikes and fixed-wing aircraft strikes in Syria and in Iraq. And it seems to be, while there was a fair amount of publicity about this in the run-up to the midterm election and around the time that there were several beheadings of Americans, I don't get the idea that this is, the major news-leading event of our time. I mean, most people seem to have accepted it as this normal state of affairs, that we're going to spend an enormous amount of money and steadily kill people on the other side of the world as the normal state of things, and that it may well go on for years. That, to me, is what's extraordinary, that this war that supposedly began on September 11th is now this ongoing state of affairs, this kind of forever war that we see no end to. The current administration acknowledges that it will not end when this president leaves office. It will continue. And I think this is a remarkable state of affairs, which has gotten far, far too little comment, it seems to me.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Danner, who is a writer, journalist, and professor. Mark Danner was a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and is a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books, and he teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, and Bard College. And his latest book is Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. And he has a new film at Vice News in collaboration with The New York Review of Books, How the U.S. Created the Islamic State. And, Mark, in terms of the actual Islamic State leadership, it's pretty clear that the prison system that the U.S. set up following the invasion and occupation of Iraq that detained 24,000 men in 24 camps, that included the top commanders of what was to become the senior leadership of the Islamic State, who were able to organize the terror group at Camp Buka right under the noses of their American jailers.
Yes, that's true. Baghdadi, of course, spent time at Camp Buka and several other major figures did as well. I mean, U.S. occupation was a kind of petri dish in which the culture of the Islamic State was born and grew. So it did come about under this American occupation, which essentially built a resistance, an Islamic resistance, underneath it in Anbar province. And that still is its strong point in Anbar province, which is, you know, where the early fighting against the United States originated, really as far back as April 2003, so very early in the occupation. And, you know, a number of the leadership, of course, this is an Islamic group, but there are very important members of the leadership who were former Ba'athists, who were members of the very Iraqi military that the United States, soon after the occupation, abruptly disbanded. So we're really seeing history from a decade ago kind of unwinding once again when you look at the leadership of this group. I mean, many of the characters are quite familiar to American military leaders, among others.
Well, one of the amazing things about the camp system that the U.S. set up, where al-Baghdadi and others were able to organize this, you know, this rump sort of Sunni movement, and of course, the key was when Bremer and the neocons disbanded the Iraqi army. One of the most amazingly brain dead acts in history, where instead of having 500,000 guys that could secure the borders and maintain the peace within the country, they kicked all these guys into the street, unemployed, armed, angry, as the country descended into chaos. It's breathtaking, the stupidity of what they did. But my understanding is from some of the people that have worked in the movement with Baghdadi, they describe being in these camps as a kind of blessing, because they were free so that they weren't going to get killed by the Shiite militias, and they were free to organize.
Yeah. Well, this is an old story about insurgent groups, that the government in place, and particularly if it's an occupying power, essentially fosters them by making of its prisons a kind of training ground for the insurgency. I mean, any of your listeners who've seen the Battle of Algiers will remember that early scenes of it take place in the major prison in Algiers, where the hero of the movie is, as we say now, radicalized. So this is a fairly old story. And it's the problem with occupations, you know, that you can't help igniting the spark of nationalism. And the United States did this in a particularly foolish way. I mean, you mentioned the dissolution of the army. One could add to that the rapid de-Ba'athification of the government, in which many powerful Sunni figures were essentially thrown out on the street, including a lot of people who really weren't that involved in nasty stuff in the regime at all. And it seemed as if from the beginning, as I say in this Vice New York Review film, the U.S. didn't recognize its basic political task, which was to somehow shift power to the majority Shia while persuading the Sunni to accept it nonviolently. And the U.S. again and again, through its policy choices, encouraged a violent reaction from the Sunni side. And, you know, the descendant of that violent reaction is in fact the Islamic State, which the United States is now fighting all over again.
So do you think that, I mean, I'm always astounded why the neocons have not been held to account, why they haven't been run out of town instead of being still on television and still in the think tanks and still having influence even within the Obama administration. You know, it's surreal. Have you ever heard of any neocon ever being held to account and asked the simple question, are you guys the stupidest people that ever came along in geopolitics, or did you have some brilliant plan that we don't know about? I mean, that's the question I'd ask.
Well, I haven't seen anybody being held to account. But, you know, Paul Krugman, the New York Times columnist, wrote some time ago that, you know, it's still the reality that in order to be taken seriously on national security policy, you have to have been wrong about the war.
meaning you have to have been in favor of the Iraq War. And I think that's true. I think we're in a situation where, you know, there were very few people at the policymaking level, both in Congress and in the administration itself, in the Bush administration at the time, and many, many others who were on the other side, in, on the Democratic side. There are very few people in those groups who were vocally against the war. There are very few. I mean, there was a very large bandwagon effect, and people just hopped on. So I think that the political elite is so compromised when it comes to Iraq. There are very few people who can point fingers who are within the political system itself and are in a position to make accusations, because everybody is compromised. And I include in that, when I talk about the political system, include the major newspapers as well, major press organs, who basically got on the bandwagon right along with them.
We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about Putin's kleptocracy. Who owns Russia? Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Karen DeWisher, who's a professor of political science in the Department of Political Science at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, and the director of the university's Havighurst Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies. Her latest book just out is Putin's Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia? Welcome to Background Briefing, Karen DeWisher.
Thank you very much for having me, Ian.
And it seems as though lately Putin is trying to provoke an incident with NATO. There have been a couple of incidents involving Russian reconnaissance planes with their transponders turned off. One back in March almost collided with a Swedish airliner, passenger airliner. There was another incident as well over the Baltic, which doesn't sound that serious in terms of how close the planes got, but nevertheless, it's creating tensions. There was a Russian submarine also in Swedish waters. Do you think that Putin is trying to provoke an incident in order to reinforce the narrative that the Russian people have completely swallowed, that the West is out to get them and that they're under siege?
Boy, it's so hard to know what is motivating this rash behavior. I mean, Russian planes have resumed their Cold War era overflights of NATO territory. Of course, NATO is also moving closer to Russia. But the thing that is so, I would say, crazy about these current events is that we have Russian planes turning off their transponders in highly crowded areas over Europe, areas where civilian flights are flying in the hundreds every day, and they're provoking Sweden, which is a non-NATO country. So do they want Sweden to join NATO? I mean, what is their view of what the likely Western reaction is to that? Sweden is, when you know, I follow the Swedish press, and they're almost on a war footing. It's become a huge issue in Sweden.
So is it possible, as apparently the German Chancellor has indicated, that Putin may be losing his mind, that here he is, a minor KGB official, that in an extraordinary three-year period that you document in your new book, Putin's Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia, Karen DeWisher, the idea that he had this meteoric rise from an unemployed ex-KGB officer to, you know, the new czar, if you will, and
he's got himself in a situation with this Russian invasion of Crimea and now the destabilization of Eastern Ukraine, the sanctions are biting. Obviously, he can blame Russia's ills on the sanctions, so it's a double-edged sword. But there's no question that the drop in oil price is hurting them enormously. So do you think he recognizes that maybe he's bitten off more than he can chew?
I do think that what he learned about how the West views him, or the rest of the world views him, in Australia during the G20 came as a sufficiently big surprise that he had to leave early. He really doesn't understand that this is not some sort of wink-wink, nod-nod world where we understand that this is the way realpolitik works and we're going to continue to take money from them and we're going to continue to treat Russia as a democratizing state, no matter how far away from this project they move. I also think that you're quite right. Putin himself, I don't know whether he has literally, clinically has problems, but I do think that he's not getting full information. That has been the case for quite some time, but the encouragement from the far right politicians who are closer to power than they used to be really propelled Putin's support for separatists in eastern Ukraine, which is not going to work, is irrational. It's not going to do anything to stabilize Ukraine, which is certainly one of his objectives. But I think that part of what he's done lately is really driven by his lack of understanding of what the West really is all about.
Again, I'm speaking with Karen DeWisher, who's a professor of political science in the Department of Political Science at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, and the director of the university's Havikhurst Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies. Her latest book just out is Putin's Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia? So if this is the case that we're not sure about his mental state, but he certainly gotten the nationalists on board. He's basically, after he announced his third term, I think he got disgusted with the liberals who rose up and demonstrated against him, you know, basically saying, well, I made you all rich and now you hate me. Right. It seems like that he's moving further and further to the right, and maybe he is surrounded by these sycophants, the Siloviki, the people that his cronies, ex-intelligence people, now turned oligarchs. But I thought that actually, even before he went to the G20 in Australia, he thought he was actually going to make a deal with the Chinese leader. And the Chinese leader turns around and makes this huge deal with Obama and then goes on to Australia to make another deal. And I thought that, again, maybe he's getting bad advice.
Right. Oh, there's no question. And the thing about the Russian-Chinese relationship, which is so interesting, is that Putin went to China. This is before Australia, way before Australia, and signed over 30 contracts. And no one has seen these contracts. No one knows actually what the deal is, and three of them have already unraveled. So those contracts are really political announcements. They don't hold any authority, and they are up for constant renegotiation. And the Chinese have said, look, the ruble is crashing. We're going to renegotiate these contracts. And so that whole, let's say, tilt toward Asia on the part of Russia is really falling apart because the Chinese don't see it as in their interest.
Well, I think it was done impetuously, too, on the Russian side to show the Russian people that, well, the West may be angry at us, but we've got other options.
That's right.
Absolutely. And maybe they don't have these other options.
No, they don't have these other options. And the thing that's quite interesting about these contracts is, you know, as anyone knows in dealing with the Chinese, you know, they're not going to take their problems with their suppliers or their providers to European courts. It's going to be dealt with, you know, person to person. at the highest level. And it looks like Putin thought he could deliver something, and actually he can't.
So, but on the other hand, Karen DeWisher, you know, we in the West, and particularly in the United States, have been guilty of dancing in the end zone, claiming victory in the Cold War. And there is no upside to triumphalism, even at this point. If Russia's in trouble, that doesn't help, does it? I mean, as you mentioned, the eastward expansion of NATO. In fact, people like Henry Kissinger have said that we have not sufficiently respected or understood Russia's security concerns. And to some extent, we've provided the narrative of this paranoia. I mean, Putin wouldn't be that successful in his anti-Western propaganda that has seized the Russian media and completely controls the, if you will, the narrative there, if the Russian people themselves didn't feel this kind of collective humiliation.
Well, perhaps, but one could also see an alternative view, which is that if the Russian people saw their own country moving in the direction of Europe in terms of truly absorbing and implementing European values, openness, open borders, respect for civil liberties, free and fair elections, even though, of course, many Western elections have problems. But I wouldn't say that we could put our hands on our hearts and say that Western elections are routinely stolen, as they have been in Russia. So, you know, there is a security portion of this, but I myself, back in the days of Cold War triumphalism, was not in favor of the expansion of NATO. So I've never been a big supporter of security systems in general. But we're now in a situation where, you know, Poland and the countries of Eastern Europe do have some right to choose their allies. And to say to them, no, we have this thing called NATO. I mean, of course, assuming that NATO wouldn't have been disbanded. We have this alliance called NATO. And because we're sensitive to Russia's security concerns, we're not going to allow you to be part of it. I mean, that also is not an argument that I would say passes the basic, you know, Bretton Woods test of allowing sovereign states to choose the alliances. I'm not a big fan of Kissinger-style arguments that say, well, Ukraine is never going to be part of NATO, so let's just throw Russia a bone. Are we really going to allow Russia to take apart a country that just had an election that we recognize?
Right. Well, furthermore, there was an agreement in 1984 signed by Russia called the Budapest Agreement, which guaranteed Ukraine's territorial integrity and sovereignty. So,
that's right.
And Russia signed on. So,
in return for denuclearizing. So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, I think that...
Well, but I think you're hitting the nail on the head here, Karen DeWisher, in terms of what the real motives of Putin are, and that is that Putin, what he offers is gangsterism and and this kind of, you call it a wink, wink, and a nod, nod. Look, we're in control. Forget about politics. You know, this is the way the system works. And, you know, we'll provide you with stability and, you know, just shut up and enjoy it. And look at the gangster that he'd installed or had been installed in Ukraine. That's what Putin offers, the Yanukovych model. And clearly it's unsustainable and people don't want it in the modern age. So at the end of the day, I don't see how, and he's done the same, of course, down in Chechnya with that Kadyrov, the
right.
Absolute gangster, thug, murderer, horrible guy.
Horrible.
So that's what he offers, and that's what he's offering the Russian people. So how is it that do they not have a choice? Do they not understand that other countries in Europe have rule of law and a high standard of living and that those things are interconnected?
They do understand it, and they understand it because millions of them have now gone on, you know, travel trips abroad and travel trips to Europe, to Turkey, to the Middle East, and so they have now, you know, the majority of the Russian population just doesn't know what it was like to live under communism. They may have had distant relatives in the past who were repressed, so they understand theoretically, but they also now are being given a pablum of revanchism, of, you know, the world has to respect us, we can be contenders. I would say it's a kind of message that this ultranationalism, ethnic purity, whiteness, labeling other people as fascist, that is very similar to very early 30s Germany. And, you know, Putin is installing people around him who are not liberals. They really are on the outs. And they are the ones who are leaving the country, and the borders are wide open for their emigration. So Putin has decided that he can build a power base, sustain it, and an economy that is strong enough without any true development strategy.
So, but he's still popular. How do you explain the 80%? If enough Russian people know what living in with rule of law and with democracy is like, and is how much more preferable it is to the rule of gangsters and thieves, which is, you know, that is, I think, Navalny got it right when he referred to Putin's party as the party of thieves and swindlers. That's what they are.
That's what they are, and that's how, you know, it's a pay-to-play system from the bottom to the top, and all the money goes up, and then once you're in power, the largesse comes down. So, but it comes down in the sense that you can use your position to earn money, but you have to always repay it with loyalty and silence. So people might talk about how the system works around their table, but in their kitchen, but the opportunity to really have a discussion about this in society is extremely limited and actually extremely dangerous. You know, I think it's, for example, important just to tell listeners that my own book is not allowed to be discussed in any Russian forum. And I know this from editors of newspapers. So they really do control everything. And when we say 80%, there's two figures I think that are important in understanding Putin. One is that the population supports him by 80%. The second is that when the population is asked whether the top leadership supports the country's interests or their own, the overwhelming majority say their own. So when the word Putin is taken out of the equation, then they have a very different view of how the country is actually being run. And I think people on the streets just no longer are going to be no longer feel able to tell a stranger who's polling that they don't support Putin by name.
So what can be done in terms of prying this grip that he's got over both the mines and the bank account of the country? He's got the control of the judiciary, the control of the media, and he's free to steal the country blind, but that's limited because, you know, I understand from a foreign policy point of view and a national security point of view, this is a new hybrid that you have now in Russia, where you have a combination of national security and organized crime, the mafia and nuclear weapons. And it is a scary concept, and I don't understand why people in the West continue to believe that this is all the West's fault. I mean, these things aren't mutually exclusive. On the one hand, you can argue that perhaps we did not understand Russian security concerns and NATO expansion may not have been the wisest thing or most necessary thing. But on the other hand, this guy's a gangster, and he's stealing the country blind, and he's dangerous. And the last thing that we can do, at least from my point of view, is take the bait if he's trying to provoke us. I mean, they're already going crazy about this $350 billion military aid package that the U.S. Congress just voted for Ukraine. So how do you navigate between, you know, how do you get to the silent majority in Russia who may know that they don't have the best deal in the world, but they don't feel they can do anything about it?
Well, I would say there's an external and internal dimension to what can be done to confront this regime. The external is that, you know, of course nobody knows the exact figures, but many people, you know, many respected economic institutions state that about half of the world's economy is in the illegal sector. And usually we think about this as there are sovereign states that are trying their best to collect taxes, and then there are economic institutions, corporations, individuals, mafia groups, and so forth, that are sitting on and moving around this vast reservoirs of cash. Russia, and not only Russia, but let's talk about Russia. Russia is an exception to this rule that the state is against this reservoir, that the state is trying to rein it in. Russia is deeply tapped into that one half of the world's economy. And I think making every effort to cut Russia off from contributing to and benefiting from that reservoir is a very desirable thing on every front. So Russia's subversion of Western economic institutions, its utilization of offshore banking. We're not talking here just about individuals. We're talking about the Russian state. So they have created a system where they are marauding through their own country and not introducing any kind of real rule of law. As you say, the judiciary is totally in their control, as is the parliament. And at the same time, they are relying on the rule of law in the West to protect their ill-gotten gains. Cutting them off from that is a really very important objective. I think that then the internal function becomes possible. The elite, not the top people who will go down with Putin and the Band of Brothers and all that, but the elite, the economic elite in Russia, which is larger than, you know, the top 12 people, they have an interest in, if they're going to be forced to keep their profits inside Russia, they have an interest in the rule of law. And they are trying their best to remind the Kremlin that if they are patriotic and bring their money back, that it should not be raided by the Kremlin. There has already been raiding by the Kremlin. And so, in a way, the battle lines are set. There, of course, could be broader social unrest, but one always looks at the top elite. Where are their interests? And if they are going to bring their money back and they can't get it out, then they're going to become much more interested in making sure that banks secure their property.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Karen DeWisher, and for your new book, Putin's Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia?
Thanks for a great program, Ian.
Thank you. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.